Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love, and this is going to be the first panel that I recorded at New York Comic Con for this year. I attended the show for 2 days, and I couldn't record all of the panels because one of them in particular, just audio recording would not have worked well. So this panel is called Science in Fiction, and it was a fantastic panel. It was a lot of fun. So here's the thing. Don't do what I do. Basically, I get too afraid of failing to try things, and in this case, I didn't start recording right away because I just assumed it wouldn't work. I sort of set myself up to fail. I was in the second to the last row, and I just didn't bother taking out the recorder for a while because I thought, you know what, this is just gonna suck. And you actually can hear, it's a little bit quieter. So when I finally took it out and hit record, I just went, you know, tested it to play it back. And you actually can hear the speakers pretty well. You might have to jack up your volume a bit during this episode. But it was a really interesting panel because the books that these authors write are all pretty different. And when you think of science fiction, I think it's such a big, huge genre that, you know, that people just might automatically only think of one thing that's in their head. Like, they might only think about Star Trek. In this case, there's an author who has like a very post-apocalyptic setting, and then there's another one where it goes back to Victorian England. So it's really interesting to see the diversity in that, and also the diversity in the characters that they talk about. And so the panelists for this were A.G. Riddle, whose book Departure he talks about, Mindy McGinnis, whose most recent book is A Madness So Discreet, and she goes into talking about lobotomies and all of her research on actual anatomy and medical procedures. And there's a really interesting part of that where she spent like a year and a half doing research and it only came to 2 paragraphs of her final book. Jordan Stratford, who I've interviewed on this show before, and he was the main reason that I actually went to this panel. His most recent book is The Case of the Missing Moonstone, and that I think is book 6 or 7 of his Wollstonecraft series. And Wollstonecraft was unbelievable. I loved it. It's about this fictionalized version where a young Ada Lovelace, before she's Ada Lovelace, she's Ada Byron, and she becomes best friends with Mary Shelley. As little girls, they open up a detective agency, and they use all kinds of like science and engineering and logic and stuff to solve crimes. It is phenomenal. There was also Ian MacDonald, whose recent book is called Luna, New Moon, Barry Liga from After the Red, and at one point the moderators switched because Peter Kleins had the wrong time, so eventually he gets there and takes over moderating. So, like I said, the recording might be a little bit low, so you might have to boost this up a bit, but I loved this discussion. I will say that it was so popular that the queue to get in was massive, and they had it scheduled in a small room, a very small room, so half of the people had to be turned away. So hopefully that sort of feedback gets back to the New York Comic Con ReadPop organizers, and the next time they try to schedule something with science and fiction together, they understand how popular it is and put them in an appropriate room, because it was a tiny room, it was horribly hot, horribly, horribly hot. Like, I don't know how I stayed awake. Not as bad as FlameCon. FlameCon was off the charts with its lack of air conditioning. So, you know, enjoy this, and I will, of course, have show notes with the names of all of these speakers so you can go, you know, search for them and find them, and then go back and listen to my past interviews with Jordan Stratford, and let me know what you think. Thanks for listening.
Actually work. It's a kind of a ratchet work computer, and it's capable of doing some fairly simple, it's programmable. So this thing could actually work. But mesmerism also appears in the first book, and we know that Ada lifelong fascination with mesmerism. In fact, she wrote a book about it. And this was considered to be legitimate science at the time. They knew that you could magnetize water and use that magnetic water for therapeutic purposes. And they had science behind that backed it up at the time, until they had more science that failed to back it up, and in fact that threw away. So I'm not only introducing scientific ideas, but I'm introducing a kind of a hermeneutic where science is kind of what you've got to work with at the time, and something, a better idea will come along, and your ideas are disposable, and that's okay. In fact, that's what makes it cool, is the fact that we only ever know so much before we learn something that completely dismantles whatever we were sure of 5 minutes ago. And it makes, from a character standpoint, it makes the world a kind of an unsteady and scary space, but it also makes it a very promising space. You don't always know what's going on, and that theme progresses throughout the series. And you know, we're talking about book 7 now in terms of the map. So everything just gets weirder, but the same kind of weirdness that you experience if you worked in the lab all the time.
So one of the things I've been hearing from all of you is there's both a, I mean, this is true in any speculative fiction, there's that what-if moment that is kind of driving, like, how the story took place, whether it's, what if, you know, there were lobotomies in the 1800s? What if there was this rain in this future that was destroying everything, or, like, a plane crashes in the future, or whatever? Is that, and I'm going to kind of keep this more open now, a little bit looser, but is that really, like, your starting point when you're writing, or was it more, like, so did you start with a scientific principle in mind, or did you start more with, like, I have this character that I really want to focus on, let's see where I can put them, let's see what she can do, what he's capable of, etc. So I'm just going to kind of throw that out there. You can dive in.
I'm going first because I have the most ignoble reason for it. in that creativity, a lot of people have a Victorian notion of creativity, that writers, creatives go up to a room, sweat in a garret, pour with their creative muse to get this brilliant thing that's hovering out there in some shapeless form down onto the page, and they sweat blood. Creativity doesn't actually work like that in reality. It's bits of random crap that fall together. Not a long time ago, I listened to a podcast called the Coon Street Podcast by an Australian editor called Jonathan Stratton and Dr. Gary K. Wolfe, who's an academic at the University of in Chicago. And they talked about science fiction. And they've been talking about near future solar system science fiction. And Gary Wolfe said, you know, there's lots of books about the new solar system, the new Mars. I'd love to see a new moon story about a new moon base. And I thought, I've always loved moon bases. And I filed that big in the corner of my mind. And then,
it does.
Yours doesn't. It's like ketones on your phone. It's great. And then, a while back, my wife was watching television. And I said, what are you watching on television? I said, I'm watching the reboot of Dallas. I said, I loved Dallas. And I watched it. And it was crap. except for Larry Hagman, who was magnificent, because he always was magnificent. I remember thinking, and that just got me thinking, family dramas, isn't that great? You know, people love family dramas. It's a thing that hasn't really been done much in science fiction. We tend to go for, you know, for either noir or thrillers, but family dramas have a place there. And I kind of thought, and it went dink, another place in my brain. And then a few days later, I was at the gym in a jacuzzi, and those two bits went pink together, and there it was, Dallas on the Moon. And it's as simple as that. Creativity is all the random crap we file away. Some people are just very good at putting those bits of random crap together and making a new thing out of it. Everything is a mashup, ultimately.
I have a very odd origin story from the seed that started a madness, so to speak. I have an addictive personality, and that doesn't mean that people like happens that I tend to do one thing for a very long period of time and think it's the best thing that ever happened, and then I'm done. And a couple of years ago, I was really into lobotomies. That was what I was into. I was reading all about lobotomies. I was fascinated by them. And I had read a biography of the doctor who was America's first lobotomist. I was reading that. I was reading The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. I was reading Arthur Conan Doyle. And I was wondering, the real impetus was, I was wondering what it would actually feel like to get a lobotomy. Because you don't have nerve endings in your brain. Your brain can't feel. So I thought, you know, barring the fact that you're punching through your occipital lobe or your temporal, you know, barring the damage to your face, I was like, you know, you wouldn't actually feel that. And I was sitting there wondering these really odd things that I wonder when I'm alone. And I looked over at my nightstand where I had The Devil in the White City, Arthur Conan Doyle, biography of a lobotomist. And I was like, oh, if I took all those and I went and I made them one book, that would be awesome. And then I thought, oh, I'm a writer, I can do that.
I'll jump in to say that for me, again, just in terms of the impetus of the project, the idea that science is not this third-party entity, that it is something that is completely natural and intuitive, and particularly is something that we have a cultural problem. We have a very significant and urgent cultural problem, which is the fact that we have a lot of challenges on this planet, and if we restrict ourselves to using half the brains on it, we're not going to catch up in time. And particularly in some really exciting fields, we are losing the female brain from participating in a large chunk of this problem solving. And what can I do about that as a bit of a shit disturber and as a parent and as a parent of a young girl? And so I was really looking at real world role models, like who are the young women who change the world as young women through the power of their curiosity and their intellect. And so in order to do that, I had to use what I call chronobanging, which is actually just an acronym, but chronobanging sounds like it involves a large wrench and more fun. So I had to kind of smash some certain things together in a timeline in order to make this work as a story, as a series, and to support the character arcs, because they're the things that they're tangling with. You know, I think it's always about finding out what your characters want and not giving it to them. And then after they've suffered for 200 pages, you give them a cookie for being good little characters and putting up with you for being a horrible author. And of course, in a series, what you have to do on the first page of the second book is take the cookie away. And you have to make them suffer for another 200 pages. So I'm such a jerk, really. But that process of character engagement in science, and by making it feel very ambient, feel like this is just a kind of a background radiation to their lives, is super important. And I get to play with all kinds of aspects. But in book three, we're into cryptography, so I get to poke all over the place in terms of subject matter, because the Regency period on the threshold of the Victorian era was such a really, really interesting time, because science became very, very mainstream and extremely popular. This is a thing, people would read scientific journals by the fire in the evening, and particularly for young women, this natural history, go out and draw flowers, but actually draw these flowers in such a way that you can identify them. Taxonomy was, the bird watching of its day. You would take this thing and you would actually figure out exactly what kind of species is this. And you'd all sit around this in the parlor and you'd discuss what species of daffodil you've discovered that day. So this was a real thing, and it concretized and it made a very immediate experience, particularly for young women, about how they navigated the world around them by kind of breaking it down into its component parts. It's a really interesting way of looking at the world, it's a really interesting way of solving problems, and it's a really interesting way to write characters.
In a very weird way, this science
research actually led me to departure. I was working on a new trilogy, and I'd spent like a year researching this new thing, and I was really burnt out on it. I mean, I was spending day after day reading these journals and planning out this character arc, something like that, and I was like, God, you know, I'd love to write something that would just be fun, that I could just start, and I could, you know, you mentioned earlier there, you could just write, and it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't have to research. You could just go and go and go, and I was like, you know, how could I do that? Well, what if a plane took off in 2015 and crash landed in the future? I can just make up whatever I want, right? And so, you know, I was researching this other series, and I was like, oh, God, I'll just write this other thing, because it'll be so much fun. And I got in a lot of trouble because, you know, Departure starts out, you know, the plane crashes, and it's all about the characters and survival. And then I got to this point where I had to back up and basically do 3 or 4 months of research on how do I make this believable? Because, you know, as a writer, we're obviously using the science to make the story believable and to help the readers suspend this belief. But for me, I was like, oh man, if I got here and I was reading this, I would not buy this. You know, this has to be explained, and you've got to sell it to me with science, right? So that was cool, and I spent 4 months in Europe traveling to some of the places that the book is set in, so that was pretty cool. So, you know, I think it's, you know, science, and we also use, you know, real things from settings, and history, I think, is just as important. But, yeah, for me, it was, you know, I think there's a balance of science and making the story fun and just wanting to write every day, so.
That sounds like fun. I'll just do that is the deadliest thing an author can think.
You get in trouble.
It does, because you think this will be so easy and so much fun, and then the next thing you know, you're on page 5024, and the book is not over. For me, you know, this was interesting because of, you know, most of my books come about in certain ways, but this is the first time one literally came to me. Because Peter and Rob, who is the other co-author, who was Peter's producing partner at the time, they sort of came up with the general framework. And they came to me and said, doesn't this sound cool? You know, let's make a book. And I was like, well, guys, this isn't really a story. You've got a couple characters, and you've sort of got this idea for a world, but that's not a story. Maybe it's a movie, but it's not a story. And Very Laggage, is it? So I thought about it a lot, and I was trying to think of ways to make it a little different from sort of other post-apocalyptic stories, because I've heard there are some out there, and what I hit on was, and again, it's just this serendipity that seems to, you know, that Ian talked about. You know, I was reading at the time a book called A World Lit Only by Fire by a guy named William Manchester, which is sort of an accounting of how the Dark Ages became the Renaissance, and there's a lot of quibbles with his scholarship, and people always yell at me whenever I bring up this book. It doesn't matter if what he's saying is true or not. What matters is how it clicked for me. One of the things he talks about is how, you know, the Dark Ages were so long that there was no generational memory of a better time. You know, if you were a poor peasant farmer, your father was a poor peasant farmer, and his father, going all the way back, nobody could remember a time when you weren't a peasant farmer, so there was no point trying to be anything but a peasant farmer, because you couldn't even imagine that there was anything else. And the more I thought about that, I thought, oh, this book isn't post-apocalyptic. This is the Dark Ages, but in the future. And that was how the book sort of clicked for me. It's, you know, my editor was like, oh, do they have the internet? And I'm like, well, no, they have something called the WikiNet, which, think about Wiki for a second. It's like the internet, but anybody can edit anything on it. So imagine how useful that is. Not at all. And so all these things just sort of clicked into place as a result, and I was given pieces from different puzzles that didn't fit together, and then I had to sort of get my chisel and my file and my rasp and make them fit together, and it was a really interesting intellectual exercise, and it was nothing I'd ever had to do before in any book. And our moderator has transmogrified Alakazam!
So this panel does not start at 5:45 like my notes say. Hi, I'm Peter Kleins. I'm moderating, but they were pretty much doing it themselves so far. I'm off the hook. And now that we're cutting, I actually wanted to ask, talking about science, because you've all mentioned this one or another, scientific research that all of us know as authors, research is very easily a black hole that you fall down and, you know,
one minute you're just looking to see, you know, how many joints in a cockroach leg, and 3 days later you're, you know, discovering a really fantastic thing about triplets. At what point, like, did you, especially, okay, when in some cases, like you're saying, we're making up science, you know, how far do you go with research, generally? Do you do just a draft and not worry about it? Do you try and figure out some stuff ahead of time?
Well, I think it's really easy to over-research. I know in my case, like I said, I really do, I am pretty confident I can perform a lobotomy. Like I said,
there'll be a demonstration later.
Even if it went wrong, you know, if it went wrong, it wouldn't really matter. So
I want to see this.
I know, and see, I'm really proud of this. But it doesn't really require a lot of skill, is the thing. But, you know, I learned so much about lobotomies. I read thousands of pages about lobotomies. And also trepanning, which, if you're familiar, is where you punch a hole in the skull so that the brain can swell.
I'm game, by the way. Like, we can do this.
Oh, we can trepan?
Like, yeah.
People do that still, like now. They use drills.
There's
YouTube.
There's a penguin party after, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, great.
It opens your third eye.
Yes, absolutely. It's amazing. People use it all the time. Odysseus knew all about it. But yeah, it was a thing that people would punch holes in their skulls if they were swelling. So their brains could come out, like a mushroom, and sit on their head, and then go back in, and you wouldn't die because your blood was blocked up. Your brain had circulation cut off. So I read surgeons' notes from the Civil War about how to trepan. I went to a Revolutionary War reenactment and talked to the guy that was pretending to be a Revolutionary War doctor, and asked him to show me how to trepan, and he did it on a melon, and the woman next to me passed out. And I was videotaping, and I thought it was the greatest thing ever. So I did all of this. I learned all about trepanning, all about lobotomies, and then I was writing the book, and I got to the scenes where this was going to be the most critical point for me to know this information. And I wrote my scene, and I was like, that's done. And it was two paragraphs. Two paragraphs. And let me tell you, you could use it, don't, but you could use it for a step-by-step on doing a lobotomy. But I had researched, I had put a year and a half of my life into learning so much, and I wrote two paragraphs. So you can really overstep. I know so much about lobotomy, so it's amazing. I'm very proud. I have to use it now. I mean, that's the thing. I wrote my two paras, and I'm like, well, now what?
All of her books will now have lobotomy.
Yeah, they will. I'm actually writing a book titled Lobotomy because I'm like, I have to use this now. I'm not actually.
I'm going to try to get away with that in my next kid's book.
A lobotomy.
Yeah.
Go for it.
My editor's in the room, so I'm just going to look for her reaction.
When you write a research-heavy book, you throw away 80% of your research. You never use it. Unless you do the research, you won't know which 80% you didn't need to use in the first place. It is a wonderfully fun black hole you can fall into, especially because writers love prevaricating. Writers will do anything rather than write. Writers usually have the cleanest houses, the neatest gardens. I'm quite sure that the Great Wall of China is probably built by writers. And research is because you feel you need just this little bit more to have that little extra angle you need the whole thing. And of course you don't. I have lovely appendices. I discovered that the Hawaiians have a lunar calendar. They have a 31-day calendar with a different name for each day of the month. And that's perfect for a society set on the moon. There's a big list of the entire Hawaiian calendar at the back of the book. It's there, should you need it. I only ever mentioned the actual Hawaiian Day of the Week twice in the entire book. It's there because I liked it. But I couldn't bear not to use it. You have your darlings. You have the bits of research that you really, really want to do. This isn't referring to this book at all. A previous adult book I wrote is called Dervish House, set in Istanbul in the near future. And I discovered a thing called a mellified man. What a mellified man is, I'll keep this short, it's a good long story. In medieval Arabia, when ancient Islamic gentlemen grew tired of life, decide to do something noble. And what they would do is they would eat honey. They used nothing but honey. 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, nothing but honey. Until they sweated honey, until their urine was honey, until they excreted honey. They would die of massive sugar poisoning. Then they would bury the body in a stone coffin, top it up with honey. I've got you guys in the palm of my hand.
And he's making all of this up.
Top it up with honey and then seal the top of the dead coffin. And they put a date on it, and that's the decant date, 200 or 300 years in the future, or even. And at that date, you would take the lid off the coffin. What you had inside was a human, basically, a human jelly, basically. It was a human body preserved in honey. And this was a very powerful cure for all manner of ills and diseases. The jinn were afraid of the power of malefied manna. If you rubbed it on a body, it would take away wounds and heal breaks. If you ate it, it was even more powerful. And I read this, and I'm putting that in the book. I don't care. I don't care what I have to do. I am putting this in my book. And I did. And people love it. But to show my dedication to my research for that, I actually got a leg of lamb, and I got a very large Kilner jar, and I have a leg of lamb. It's been in honey for about 7 or 8 years now, so I may leave it a little bit longer just to see what comes out of it. It's like the trepanning in the water. There are bits you come across that you love so much you would do anything to get them in there.
Yeah, I kind of ran into the basics where I've got a character who's the world's first computer programmer. So how do you actually start from a mechanical phenomena of something that going tick, or in case of a zero in a binary language, something not going tick? And how can you take something as abstract as an event, or the weather, or mood, or physical evidence gatherer, scene, or an observation, and translate that from its very initial instance into a tick or a non-tick, and what does that look like? And so I ended up having creating all these different models for what would be the most primitive computer that you could actually build. And I created a system where I put spindles with holes in them, and you can either fill the hole with something, and it turns and it ratchets, and either it sets up a counter, and the thing is either counted or not. But then all you're really doing is looking at something that can count more than one thing at a time. And then you have to extrapolate patterns from that. And the software for extrapolating that patterns doesn't actually exist for well past, even when we get well into electronic computing, and well past that. So we could count data for a long time before we actually knew what the hell we were looking at. And so then to scale that back into something that can click with the mind a very bright and inquisitive 11-year-old girl, it was definitely pushing the bounds. So at some point, I just have to kind of back off and say, computer science exists. Just bear with me. It's a thing. It really is a thing, and it's possible. And so it does become, there's a degree of MacGuffining that I think you have to introduce in fiction. Otherwise, it's like, okay, kids, well, let's sit around the campfire. We're all going to do Comp Sci 101. And 6 months later, they all walk around and they're applying for jobs at Microsoft, but they haven't finished your novel yet, and you're not really doing the reader any favors at that point. Sometimes you just have to kind of go and say, "Trust me, this sounds very convincing at the time."
That's actually a great point. When do you find that point where, okay, these things we need to have hard science, we need to have numbers, we need to have math, we need things we can back up, and then the soft science stuff where it's like, just trust me, this works. We're going to reverse the polarity of the neutron flow. It'll be fine. And it'll solve everything.
Since neutrons are neutral by definition, I don't know how you can reverse the polarity. But anyway, it's very technical. Insert babble here. I've always felt like you sort of, it's sort of like tricking children into getting into your van.
I was never on this panel.
You want to give them enough candy to get them closer, and then once they're in, that's when you slam the door, and then you don't have to worry about the candy anymore. And but I mean, you that sort of, you know, you want to treat the reader that way. You know, I wrote serial killer books. You're seducing the reader. You're telling the reader, look at this, and the reader goes, oh yeah, that makes sense. And you're telling the reader, look at this, and they go, that makes sense. And look at this, that makes sense. And you've backed all that stuff up, and then you go, now look at this, and they go, well, that, yeah, okay, all those other things made sense, so I guess this makes sense too. And it's it's how you make that transition, over. And I mean, honestly, people hate when I say this, but it really it's one of those things where when you're writing, it becomes a gut feeling, I think. I don't think that there's a matrix or a schedule or a graph or anything like that that shows you, okay, after four paragraphs of actual scientific information, the reader is mentally prepared, you know, for this, or is primed for this. You just go with your gut. And for me, it usually becomes when I'm tired of going from my notes to the keyboard. You know, it's like, okay, I'm tired of looking this shit up. I'm just going to go with it now, and hopefully it'll work.
Yeah, I think the first draft is always kind of instincts, and there is this kind of propensity to put all the research in there because you did the work, and, you know, you love the research. And I know what I'm talking about, because you got to trust me. But the other thing is you get tons of emails from readers. So over time, you collect so much data, and you kind of know where people stop believing in certain things. So for me, I mean, I'm a pretty young writer, and when I wrote my first novel, I knew I wasn't, that the story and the research was better in my writing, so I leaned more, you know, that novel was a techno thriller, it was much more science heavy, because I was like, God, you know, even if they don't like the characters and the story, I mean, the science gets great of me, it's really interesting, and they may as well read it, but I think, you know, this is my fourth novel, so, you know, when I was writing it, it was really, what story do I want to tell, and now what science do I need to have readers believe that story? So definitely my research process has changed a bit. It's still, I mean, you know, I got a lot of emails from readers on Departure, and I'd kind of learned a lot more. It's like, oh, well, I stopped believing here, or I believe the whole thing, or love the whole thing. So I think you learn with every novel. We never get it right.
I think that there is a fear, and a valid point. When you are creating science, that can make so much sense that actually removes mystery from the equation, and it moves it just shatters that suspension of disbelief. I call it the midichlorian problem.
Yeah. I wouldn't use the analogy quite of enticing children to my van.
What are you hiding? Why are you afraid of using that metaphor? An innocent man would not be afraid of it.
My way of thinking of it is more like passing a foreign coin off in your loose change. there you go. Elegant, concise, and accurate. In that, for it to go into the machine, it has to be of a similar size to a true coin. It has to be of a similar weight to a true coin, but it doesn't have to be a true coin. In other words, it has to be sciencey enough to be passable. It has to fit with the rest of what you're passing off as real science to not kind of stick up like a sore thumb. So choose your analogies. Pedophile, small change, speech. Choose wisely.
I didn't say anything about pedophilia.
No, he just said he was giving candy to children. Yeah.
You have no idea.
Transportation.
I'm interested that that's right where you went. That's very interesting.
He's a school bus driver. It's fine. When I was writing In a Handful of Deaths, which is the second in my post-apocalyptic survival duology, there was a moment when my characters ended up way out west, and I was dealing with people who do not have enough water to drink, and everyone is always saying that the human body is 80% water, and I get very tired of cannibalism being touted as, like, this is the worst thing you can do. Eating people is really bad. And, you know, when the first time I came across it is, but... You know, it's like the first time I came across cannibalism when I was like 12, and I don't mean like I tried it. I mean like I read it, saw it, whatever. And I was like, wow, that's terrible. And I'm
past, you know, the shock factor's gone. I'm like, yes, we understand cannibals. And I was tired of that. So I'm like, okay, so what if you're not eating people, but you're drinking them? Yeah, I know. I'm like, how do you get, okay, so there's 80% of your body is water. How do we get that out? And so I did some Googling. And I had, so no one should ever look, I really was paranoid. I'm like, no one should ever look at the history on my computer because they're going to be like, wow. But, you know, usually you do a Google search and you have 4 or 5 pages to scroll through. You have to sort out your information. I Googled, how do you get water out of the human body? It's like, Google is like, I don't know. And I'm like, oh, man. Okay, so it's in there. You can get it out. I'm going to play with that. So I have a friend that is a surgeon, and I came up with a method. And I said, Lydia, would this work? She emailed me back, and she said, yeah, technically that would work. And I was like, awesome. Thanks, man. And so people, whenever when I do things, people that have read the second book, they say, Mindy, I have to ask you, where did you come up with this thing in the book with, you know, when that happens? And I said, oh, I made that up. And I came out of my head. And they're like, oh, okay. It's way worse. It's like worse than when you start talking about bands. Yeah. They're scared. It's weird. So, but would it actually work? I don't know. I hope I'm never in a situation where I have to find out. But yeah, if supposedly, according to, you know, the technicals, yes, it would.
We could do that after the lobotomy.
Yeah, I've got all I have lists.
Patients are very cooperative at that point.
Yeah, I have like a check mark, like I have lists with check mark boxes, so I mean,
if you look under your seats, you'll find a number. Let me, we're probably going to, we got a little time left to take questions. I got one more question for you. To flip it around, no one has to name anything. But why do you think it is, everyone here has a really great science-based book, set in the past, in the future. You get other books like, the one that pops to mind is The Martian by Andy Weir, which, I mean, the guy has 6 pages on how to grow potatoes. You know, and here's another 4 pages on how we make water. Why is it that some writers get away with this, that we can have all our scientific stuff, and other writers have 3 paragraphs of exposition and they lose you right there? What do you think is the mistake being made?
I think in the case of The Martian, it comes down to voice. I really do. I mean, Mark Watley's voice, right? I mean, the opening line of that book, I'm pretty much fucked. Right from the opening line of that book, he's got you with an interesting character and a great voice. And so, yeah, when he's, you know, describing the quite dry and boring process of growing potatoes in Martian soil, which I mean dry and boring in terms of the actual steps taken, not the fact that, holy crap, this guy just grew potatoes on Mars. When he's doing that, you're along for the ride because it's Mark Watley, and Mark Watley's fun, and he's thinking about Aquaman, and, you know, and it's interesting, and I think, I really think that's what it comes down to, for the most part.
Yeah, I think a really good writer can write about anything and hold your interest. Devil in the White City by Eric Larson is about America's first serial killer, but it's also about the Chicago World's Fair, and there's a huge amount of that book dedicated to the different plants that were grown for the Chicago World's Fair.
How they built the Ferris
wheel. It's talking about how it's really hard to build tall buildings in Chicago because of the silt. And you're just like, oh. And you learn a lot, and you're fascinated. And you go and you tell people, you're like, I just read this great book about silt. And they're just like, but oh, Devil in the White City is amazing. Yeah, exactly.
Anyone else? Anyone have any questions?
Looks at his clock and has a hologram projection of the time. Like, that's just a horrible It's slightly different in writing because every detail has to be a telling detail. Otherwise, it's like those terrible boring girls going about the size of pistols and all that in a particular make. It's just kind of detail for detail's sake. I think in the kind of stuff we do, every detail has to earn its place and tell you either something about the character it's related to, or the story as it unfolds, or the world in which those characters are related. In this one, people 3D print their clothes. You finish the clothes there, you throw them in the hopper, deprint them, you print something out the next day. If you can print clothes there, you can print any style you want. So I got thinking, well, in most science fiction people, most sci-fi, the clothes suck. They're really sucky. I thought, well, if you can print your own clothes, why not have it from one of the more elegant decades, the 1950s? So the women's dresses are all like, so all the women look like look like Grace Kelly in this book. The men have impeccable suits with pocket squares. Yeah, because you can print your own clothes. So why not make something that looks good rather than something that looks sucky? That tells you something about the way, you know, what the characters' values are, you know, their personal style and how the world works, all in one kind of fairly small, simple detail, 1950s fashion. So that detail earns its place. Tells you about the world, tells you about the characters once more.
And it's also a great detail because you're just building off the technology we all know.
Yep.
We understand immediately what 3D printing is, even if you're using it in a whole new way we've never seen before.
Yep.
So, there was actually right there, I think.
As a fellow writer, I find that science becomes a device for the story. And the best story is that the device becomes a character in and of itself. How far into a story have you gotten with, you know, an important device, a important scientific element that you use, where you found, you know what, this isn't going to work for me anymore. I've done my research, and no longer is what I want it to be. And it's helped me out. How far into a story have you gotten where you said, well, now I've really got to change this whole thing and go backtrack? The whole point is found in science and story. I found that, you can make things up and you can read things, but eventually, in many cases, modern day science catches up with your story and makes it irrelevant. So how far have we got? And how have you done that?
I would throw in, Chekhov has this wonderful bit, but that if there's a gun in the first scene, the gun has to go off before the end of the play. If there's a phaser in the first scene. So, when I crafted this book, I actually crafted this series, and so I have all these guns lying around. I have that don't go off in the first book. You know, everybody walks past this umbrella stand or whatever it is, and then you get these little notes from editing. It's like nothing happens to this umbrella stand, and you mention it three times, and just wait. I have a plan for it. And it's, you know, the end of the second book or the end of the third book meeting. It's like, but can we get rid of that umbrella stand you mentioned? It's like, just wait. So I don't write back, I just write forward. And so it's like, okay, I just need a bigger idea to encompass the thing. If I go down some kind of rabbit hole, I'll find a rabbit at the end of it. You know, that's it. If you paint yourself into a corner, then you just need a sledgehammer or some kind of, you know, dynamite ex machina. That's part of it. I'm not a fan of unwriting or going back. It's just like just grab them and go.
Follow up that you got the story that made it to the ninth chapter out of 15, and you introduce a new element. It changes something about it. So going back and rewriting it that way. Or you can't take a sledgehammer to something when you add something and it affects the back.
Didn't say I had to be coherent. Also, you know, that's why there are editors. Honestly, you can sometimes you just like, okay, well, I'm just balls out and I'm going to go down off this crazy direction. And, you know, sometimes you can get away with it. You can actually surprise yourself by the time you get to chapter 15. You go, this actually they all kind of lined up really well. It's like I planned it all out. And your editor says, no, that didn't. What are you talking about? And, you know, the global find your place. And 30 seconds later, the problem is solved. So that's not so much a part of the writing process as rewriting. I think, you know, there's writing is rewriting, of course, we all know this. But, I would, as advice, as much as any writer can never give another writer advice, because you know, you're the one who has to live with a book in your head, just go forward. Don't go backwards, just go forward. Ken, back.
Thank you. If you need to fudge the science in your story, so for example, in The Martian, you need the windstorm on Mars, never mind that the air has really been there. If you need to fudge the science, how do you combine that with a really hard, really well-researched science? Do you want it to be as smooth as possible, or do you ever feel, you know, apologetic for having to put in a few fibs to make the story work?
I normally, I'm lying through the whole book. I mean, none of this ever happened personally, so if I have to lie more about one thing, it doesn't really change it for me. Honestly, if I've done it right, you should be able to spot the lie.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I tend to think of it as like skating over thin ice. You know, if you know there's thin ice under your plot or your science, if you go fast enough, you'll get over it, okay? So kind of, yeah, take it at speed and just have a bit of chutzpah about it, really.
Well, and at the end of the day, we want to put as much research as possible. We are writing fiction. We are writing stories about things that never happened to people that don't exist. So if we have to lie a little bit, I mean, yes, definitely. You just go for it and just push past that.
And recognize that there's always going to be at least one reader who knows more about the topic than you and is very happy to tell you what a screw-up you are. And realize, seriously, it doesn't matter. That book's just not for that person. Like, you know, we all have areas that we know very well. And if you read a novel set in that area, in that milieu, and you read it, and you found something that just was completely false and just didn't work for you and pulled you out of the book and killed the book for you, that book's just not for you, you know? We all have the right to read books that we enjoy. We don't have the right to have every book be one that we enjoy. So put down the book and go read something that's not going to make you pull your hair out. You're going to get readers like that, and oh well. There's nothing you can do about it. Unless you're just going to write a very dry recitation of fact. Even then, somebody will complain about it.
I've only had one complaint about factual errors in my book. It was an old fantasy book I wrote years ago in the 1990s, and it was a typewritten letter, and it was to do with tractors. The whole thing. And I mentioned a particular brand of Massey Ferguson tractor in the year 1931. Saying, I think you'll find that this version of the Massey Ferguson was not available until 1933. Only one.
Clearly, your book takes place in an alternate universe where that tractor was available 2 years earlier.
Sorry, how much candy do you have to offer the kids to get into your tractor before you lobotomize them?
In the back, over there.
I had a question about resources. So, like, what sources do you like to use or have found? Anything from like Google to Civil War reenactments, you were saying, or how do you find these, or what things, sources do you find interesting or fun to use?
Just about anything. I mean, everyone is a resource for something. And pretty much you have a conversation with someone and you're going to learn something new. And you find people or things, books, reenactments, anything near you. Obviously, Google brings everything nearer to us, but the internet is very important. But again, I always double check anything that I find on the internet. I'm also a librarian, so I'm never going to just be like, oh, Wikipedia said, so it's cool. So, you know, I double check everything, and I have to have things definitely be as accurate as possible. But there are resources everywhere. Just having a conversation with someone can spring an entire novel. Everything is a resource, I feel.
I write for 11-year-old girls. They all have superpowers. And if you sit down and you ask 20 random questions from an 11-year-old girl, I guarantee she'll blow your minds off so far there will be skull fragments on the ceiling.
They are just amazing little humans, and they look at the world in this incredible way that will just completely upset any kind of operating set you enter the conversation with.
For this book, just one till Google Moon. Amazing.
I think we have time for one last question. If it's a quick question, right in the front.
You might not be a novelist. You might be a short story writer or a novella writer or a screenplay writer. There's nothing wrong with any of that. You know, it's not just how do I make it longer. It's, if you know, you said what if you have a lot of important scenes? Every scene should be important. It, you don't break up the book and go, well, today I'm going to write an important scene. Tomorrow I'll write some of the ones that really don't matter. They all matter. And if you have enough of them to fill 40 pages, your story is 40 pages long. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't beat yourself up. Don't go, but it's supposed to be 300. No, it's supposed to be exactly as long as it's supposed to be. It's like my high school Spanish teacher used to say, when we would say, how long do our essays have to be? She would say, make it like a skirt, long enough to cover the topic, but short enough to be interesting.
And on that note,
everyone, it's Amber. I hope that you enjoyed listening to the Science in Fiction panel from New York Comic Con 2015. And don't forget that you can sponsor the show on the website by going to patreon.com/AmberUnmasked. And you can sponsor the show for as little as $1 per week. And it's really, really helpful for me if you do that. So thanks for listening and thanks for sponsoring the show. And it makes sure that I get to places like New York Comic Con in the future.